It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a trip through the creative mind of a New Orleans chef on this week's edition of Food Friday. First, when schools closed down in the early days of the pandemic, it had a big effect on kids' lives and the lives of the people who take care of them. Kids had to change how they learned. Many of them couldn't see their friends, and that didn't just affect their learning. It had an impact on their mental health. Our next guest reported on education for years. She says the U.S. fell short when it came to caring for kids during the pandemic, and she says that was a symptom of a longer-term problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have kids who had to go through school closures and virtual learning, or you were one of those kids yourself, what was it like? What shortfalls did you see? Where did you see things falling behind? Have you caught up since then, or are you still working on it? If you work in education, what are you seeing now with the kids in your classrooms? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anya Kamenetz covered education for NPR for 8 years. She's the author of the new book, The Stolen Year: How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. Anya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to take us back to the early days of the pandemic. You were an education reporter. You'd reported on how disasters affected kids and learning. What was going through your mind in terms of hopes and fears of what would happen when schools started to close?
So when schools shut down in New York City and all over the world in mid-March of 2020, I was home in my home office. I had two daughters who were 3 and 8 years old at the time. And I had been in New Orleans just a few weeks after Katrina and seen how the upending of kids' lives with schools closed in that city for a few months really had long-lasting ripple impacts. And so I kind of knew that school closures were going to be a really big deal for American kids, but none of us, of course, could have imagined that they would go on so long.
You were hopeful, I think, that some of the lessons learned from Katrina and those school closures would give us some guideposts on what to do when schools close because of the pandemic. What did you hope we might have taken out of it that maybe we didn't?
I mean, it was really about the fact that there were so many underlying inequities. There are so many kids living in poverty and dealing with the effects of systemic racism and the lack of social supports in our country, not only in Louisiana, but all over the country. And so I really was astonished to see that while our leaders talked a lot about kind of the fact that there were a lot of kids out there that were needy, we didn't do what it took to actually make up for the loss of school. There were a lot of hard efforts made to give out school lunch, sandwiches in parking lots and drive around hotspots and computers, but the real problems were not being addressed. And as the closures went on and on, especially in blue states, I think it was really shocking to me and to a lot of people that were watching.
The heart of your book is your reporting with families experiencing this in real time. You were on Zoom or a comparable thing with some of your informants over the years. Can you introduce us to a couple of the families you met and what they experienced?
Sure. So Jeannie lives in rural Oklahoma, and her family are members of the Cherokee Nation. And she is a teacher who really took refuge in school as a kid growing up when times were tough. And it was that same school where she taught, where all five of her children attended. And so when school shut down, it was the loss of, she said, of a safe place for her and for many people in her community that she said suffered the effects of childhood trauma. Her own children had a real range of reactions to the pandemic. And it really shows how, there's so many different impacts across kids all over the country. In California, I profiled a family that had a son with autism, dyslexia, ADHD, and really, really struggled with remote learning, was very explosive. And that family, on top of that, took on an emergency foster care brother, a young boy who was best friends with their son and was a recent immigrant from Southeast Asia. So then they had basically these two kids growing up together, and both of them struggling with remote learning in their own ways.
You compare and contrast the response in the U.S. and our schools here to countries around the world. What did you see different from between the U.S. and especially more other industrial countries when it came to how they prioritized their kids and their schools?
Yeah, I think that's just such an important question. You know, obviously, we all would wish that we would be New Zealand or South Korea and countries that just limited transmission and were able to reopen schools with no controversy and without the loss of life. But where I really think the contrast gets sharp is with countries like the UK, France, Israel, Italy, Spain, and Scandinavia, where they started reopening schools in the spring of 2020. And certainly by the fall of 2020, there was a very strong commitment on the part of the European equivalent of the CDC, as well as the World Health Organization, in saying that closing schools in all cases should be a last resort. And what that meant in practice was that when subsequent waves of the disease came in the fall of 2020, all the way into 2021, these countries were willing to close bars and restaurants and public facilities while keeping schools open as an essential service. And that's exactly what we didn't do in the United States.
Talking to Anya Kamenetz, her new book is called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share, how did COVID change your children's lives? How did school closures affect their ability to learn? Do you feel like they've caught up? If you're one of the kids who had that weird lost year plus during a school closure during COVID, love to hear from you what you thought of the experience, what worked, what didn't work. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. A big part of the story, Anya, of course, remote schooling, remote learning. How did you see that falling short, especially for some of the families you talked to?
So I really want to acknowledge that teachers worked incredibly hard. They changed everything about their job on a dime, and they tried really hard to reach students, but there were so many obstacles. Obviously, basic connectivity, you know, many, many parents reported not having reliable internet, having too many people in a small space, I think we can all relate to, or not having the equipment that they needed. And even if they did, there were many places where kids, you know, turned off their cameras, really disengaged. You know, being truant used to involve, you know, getting up and leaving school. But during remote learning, all it took was clicking to another browser window. And even in my circle of friends and family, I heard so many stories of kids that were absentee, were watching YouTube or playing Minecraft. And it took weeks sometimes for the school to notify anyone.
You talked to some experts on education as well in the course of writing the book. What do we know about bouncing back from some of the learning loss that those kids you're talking about might have experienced?
Sure. I mean, you know, learning trajectories are totally individual. And so, you know, we can't make sweeping generalizations. We can say on average that in terms of math scores, in terms of reading scores, it's going to take years. The latest numbers kind of suggest that for elementary school students, on average, it would take 3 years to recover the learning trajectory you would expect them to be on starting in 2019. There are some states and localities where they really have redoubled their efforts and added extra resources, and kids are catching up a little bit faster than that. But years is the correct expectation, I think, overall.
You make the case throughout the book, I think, Anya, that the pandemic was an acute symptom of a chronic problem in how we value children and how we prioritize children. Can you talk about what you see the pandemic exposing that we could have seen as problems for years, even leading up to it?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you asked that. And it was really, truly bewildering to me because I was like, okay, progressives care about kids. Like, that's what they do. You know, they care about families. And yet here we are sitting in the middle of this catastrophe, and somehow we're missing the mark. We're not prioritizing children. We're letting other things take precedence. And then you start to look around and you realize, why is it this country, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, is one of the only wealthy countries that doesn't have subsidized childcare, doesn't have paid leave, doesn't have any kind of income supplement, which other rich countries do to prevent child poverty. We have more children growing up in poverty than members of any other age group. So let that sink in. How did we allow that to happen? We have social security for the elderly and no compensation for families with kids. And it's the deep historical reasons behind that and sort of the exceptionalism in the United States that the historical parts of the book try to explore.
We're talking to Anya Kamenetz, previously a longtime education reporter at NPR, author of the new book, The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your personal experiences as a parent, a student, a teacher. How did the school closures in particular affect learning, socializing, mental and emotional well-being? How have things gone since school came back into session? What are you thinking as you head into a new school year? Big picture, do you think we kept schools closed too long in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Anya Kamenetz about her new book. It's called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your memories, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to our callers now. Angela is with us in Waukesha. Angela, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, we know that the educational experience is really different depending on where students and families were, even within the same state. So the school that I teach at, we didn't close in the fall. We had the short closure in the spring, but we were back up and running in the fall as usual, which is social distancing and mask wearing. And I'm wondering if they've looked at childhood development and educational progress for those students who really had limited online learning and were in school sort of as usual after sort of that like 2 month break in the spring, or are there other factors at play with learning loss maybe for those students? And I can take my answer off there.
Angela, thanks for the call. And Anya, I'm guessing this is something that researchers are going to be researching for years to come. But do we have thoughts, do we have inklings on what the difference might have been for those kids who came back to school in fall of 2020 versus those who stayed virtual?
Yeah, that's a really great point the caller brought up, because there were many places around the country where schools did reopen with various degrees of restrictions in the fall of 2020. And basically, the longer kids were in remote, the more learning impacts that we're seeing. That's in the test scores this year. So that's the general overview. We're also seeing some indications that prolonged remote learning had more social and emotional impacts on students as well. There were obviously lots of interruptions in education, not only in the 2020-2021 school year, but also in the school year just ended. There was Omicron, there were personnel shortages, and there were quarantines that sent kids home. So there's a lot of what was called, normally in normal times we call chronic absenteeism, but you know, if you're sending kids home for a 10-day quarantine, which happens in a lot of places, that was also a blow as well. So people are really in a lot of different places. It's really all over the place. But the shorthand response is the less remote learning, the more kids were able to stay on track.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Leanne is with us in Madison. Leanne, hello.
Hi. I said to your telephone person, I don't think the question is so much about what, you know, the question is, what should we do now? Because we've come up with lots of concerns about schooling. Your previous person just talked about how critical it is to have a person involved in this, not to do everything online, not to do everything, you know, on a computer and remotely. We've got to do some rethinking about this, and how are we going to involve communities, parents, you know, the whole family in educating our kids and making them the priority that they deserve to be.
Leanne, thanks for the call. That takes us to the last part of your subtitle, Anya. Where we go now?
Absolutely. I guess a bright spot here is that schools received, depending on how you count, about $122 billion in federal funding, which actually is a lot of money. Schools spend a lot of money, so big numbers don't always mean a lot, but this is a lot of money. They have till 2024 in most cases to spend it. And they are. They're spending on an extra learning time, a lot of summer programs, tutoring, and social and emotional learning, because I think everybody agrees, teachers and parents will tell you that they're more concerned about students' well-being than they are about, you know, numbers on a test score that can get ameliorated gradually over time, although they're both important. So schools are making the effort. There's a couple of headwinds, though. Obviously, we've heard a lot about staffing shortages. And some of that is, you know, the labor market we're in, the great resignation. Some of it is the emotional headwinds and the burnout a lot of teachers are expressing, and trying to fill up that pipeline, you know, with qualified folks, especially in areas like special education, especially in counselors. So this is a really big issue. Where are those people going to come from? The other big issue is that there's headwinds as far as enrollment. So enrollment dropped historically during the pandemic. The only time we've seen it in modern times was during World War II, when high school students left because of the war effort and the work situation then. So there were so many students left public schools, and demographics are showing a continuing decline in public school enrollment because of immigration and birth rates. So you look at a long-term future of fewer students in public schools, how do we manage the resources that we have? Because we tend to fund our schools based on headcount. And so how do we make sure that schools stay enriched and stay abundant in the resources to help the students that are there?
Thanks for that call, Leanne, at 800-642-1234. Anya Kamenetz is with us talking about her new book. It's called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you want to share your experience, what you're seeing in schools now as a student, parent, or teacher, solutions, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Anya, I wanted to talk in particular about students with various kinds of special needs. You mentioned one of the families you talked to in California. How were they in particular affected by school closures?
Really detrimentally. I mean, there were a few students who, for example, that it's ADHD or social anxiety, that had some successes with remote learning. But for the most part, families told me that their students really suffered without access to the interventions and the therapies that they're used to getting. Zoom just was not an effective way to deliver a lot of those interventions and therapies. A lot of students actually regressed. They fell behind in their development. And so there's a lot of calls for compensation and really a big need to update students' plans so that they get the services that they need. And just everywhere I look, I hear about families that are really struggling to get students the help that they need right now.
Flipping things around, a lot of the students we were just talking about might have something called an IEP, I think Individualized Educational Plan. You float the idea in the book, or maybe you're quoting somebody else, I can't remember, but the idea of not just them, every student having an individualized educational plan, given that one size doesn't always fit all. What might that look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an exciting idea. And I think there have been people talking about it for a long time, but particularly now, because I think one of the silver linings of remote learning is that as parents, we got to know our children's learning styles on a lot more intimate level than we may have before. And so how do we build on that? And how do we ensure that each child is getting the learning that they need after kind of being on their own trajectories during remote learning? This would take resources. It would take using the resources that we have differently. But we certainly know that one size fits all is not the best model for kids, especially in this, you know, kind of fast moving, complex society that we're in.
Another issue you spent a chapter on in the book actually is childcare, a problem before the pandemic, a problem now in these, you know, 2 or 3 years in. Can you talk about what happened with the childcare crisis in the midst of the pandemic?
Oh my gosh. I mean, as much as we talk about the school closure crisis, childcare is such a fragmented field. It's actually one of the experts I said, you know, said it's like it's exaggerating to call it a system, because we have people taking in, you know, kids into their homes. We have Head Start centers that don't serve enough. We have private daycares that pay very low wages without subsidies and are still extremely expensive for families. During the pandemic, some of them shut down. Others kept operating, but they really had very little centralized guidance about how to do so safely. So there was a lot of nervousness. They had to close all the time. I mean, it was a very long time before there were vaccines available for this age group. So it was a big mess. A lot of people left the field. and we're not able to be hired back, because if you can get $25 an hour or $20 an hour working at Costco or an Amazon warehouse, and a childcare center where you're holding babies all day is $12 an hour, it's going to be very, very hard. So there's childcare deserts, and federal subsidy programs, which were on the table with Build Back Better, have evaporated. So people, advocates are really saying, we need help here. Something's got to give.
Time for one more caller. Danny is with us in Green Bay. Danny, hi.
Hi, guys. Great topic. Yeah, I just wanted to chime in and concur with your guest. When I was starting teaching, my mentor was a special ed teacher, and I was very blessed because I learned to approach all the kids the way special ed teachers approach their kids, and to try to individualize curriculum because, as your guest said, every kid learns in a different way.
Danny, thanks for the call. Are you hopeful, Anya, that coming out of this pandemic, we can learn some lessons, maybe rethink the basics that we were doing before the pandemic in ways that you mentioned and that Danny was just talking about?
I think there's opportunities to do it, but you know, you don't innovate coming out of a defensive crouch. And so the more that schools feel kind of beleaguered by these fights over things like CRT or, you know, LGBTQ rights, the less they feel like they're in a space where they can really think differently and think expansively. I know there are some school leaders out there that are keeping their eyes on the prize and that are trying to innovate. But we kind of need to give them a little more help and grace so that they can do it.
Thanks for the call, Danny. Anya, just in our last half a minute, after working with these families over the course of more than a year, you got to meet them in person briefly. What was it like?
It was incredible. It was so emotional. You know, I drove from St. Louis to rural Oklahoma to meet two of my families. And I also flew out to California and obviously New York, Washington, D.C. And just, you know, seeing the kids, and this was April 21, and you know, people were vaccinated, and being able to be there in person, you know, what you see is that even if a family on paper is really struggling, and I heard so much about the hard times, when you get into the room with someone, you see the love that's there, you see the care that they have for each other, and the optimism for the future. I mean, that's really what it's all about.
Anya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
That was Anya Kamenetz, author of the new book, The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. We've got a link to info about the book online at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, a New Orleans-based chef talks about his new cookbook on this edition of Food Friday with a focus on some creative sandwich making. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Biden announced federal action to cancel some student loan debt this week. We'll find out who it affects, how it works, and what it means for the future of higher education. Now it's time for Food Friday. Our guest says he likes food that's loud and hits you over the head. Some samples: lobster tostadas, fried bologna sandwiches with salt and vinegar potato chips, and triple-decker hot pastrami and coleslaw sandwiches. In his New Orleans restaurant, Turkey and the Wolf, he features creative mishmashes of Southern classics and offbeat gas station favorites. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's focus in on those sandwiches. Do you have a favorite sandwich of all time, one that you made or a parent made or that you got at a restaurant? Do you like to incorporate what other people might see as weird stuff into your sandwiches? What questions do you have about Southern cooking? Do you have some guilty pleasure food that you love to make and maybe you don't even feel that guilty about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mason Hereford is a chef and author of Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans, which compiles recipes from his New Orleans restaurant of the same name. Mason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm pumped.
Me too. And here's why. Before we get into the food, you know, I know running a restaurant's hard work and cooking can be a chore, but one thing I really took away from your book is, I think, you want us to have fun cooking, right?
Yeah, that's the whole idea. You know, we opened our sandwich shop in New Orleans, Turkey and the Wolf, with that being like, you know, a main concern of ours is how to get work done, run a profitable restaurant to a certain degree, but more importantly, how to have fun and show up to work every day. And that was the same sort of idea behind writing a cookbook. It's, you know, show people there's fun to be had out there and try to give them access to that fun.
One of your inspirations, you write, is sandwiches and other foods you picked up at gas stations growing up as a kid. Can you talk about that source of your culinary inspiration?
Sure. You know, that just happened to be my most formative food memories at the sort of the youngest age would be the gas station down the street, down the road from my house, because I kind of grew up out in the country. And, you know, everybody, I imagine, has these memories of when they were young and the things they used to eat. And I'm, you know, some of the biggest and earliest flavor explosions in my memories were like bags of Doritos and, you know, cans of Pringles and Coca-Cola and junk food that's bad for you. But obviously, like, the flavor's dialed up to 10. So maybe those are why they stick in my head. And I'm not sure I'm like a guy that just mixes junk food together. But I will say, I think that I like big flavors, and a lot of that might be because of the food I grew up eating.
Now, you focus on sandwiches a lot, and I love a good sandwich. I often order sandwiches at restaurants, but when I make a sandwich at home, I don't know, it's like a plan B or a default, and I don't have respect sometimes for the sandwiches. Pump me up for some respect for sandwich making at home.
Yeah, you know, not the first time I've talked, I've had the conversation about respecting sandwiches. I think every culture has their hand foods and their street foods that are awesome. One cool thing about the sandwich is that you're going to eat the same bite over and over again. So, you know, you really got to think about it. And to put a few things onto a plate, you can play off each other. You know, if you've got like mashed potatoes and gravy and peas and turkey on Thanksgiving or whatever, you can have a bite with this on it, a bite with that, mix and match. The sandwich is the same bite over and over again. So I think it really requires you to be thoughtful about what you're eating because you don't want to get bored and you want to make sure you nail it. So building a sandwich, I think, can oftentimes be more pressure than just putting some things on a plate.
Now, sometimes on Food Friday, I see a piece of practical advice and my head explodes and I'm like, I want to go home right now and try it. This one is so basic, but okay. So I make a sandwich at home. I either have the bread, you know, I guess raw, or I put it in the toaster. No, you want us to roast it in a pan, let it breathe. Tell us what goes into getting that bread ready and why you do it that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, seeing as there is only one component that's on every sandwich, and that would be the sandwich, the bread, the thing you're sandwiching with. And the bread is very important. So, you know, there's other conversations about how to select your bread and how to think of it as an actual ingredient. But for a lot of sandwiches, I find, you know, buttered toast is a very delectable sandwich ingredient. When I'm using white bread, which is in this cookbook, I think a good portion of sandwiches, maybe half of them are on, you know, thick cut buttered white bread. And the idea, the idea there is you cut it thick because you want to be able to toast it and get two textures out of it. You want it crispy on the outside and sort of soft on the middle is how I like it. And to achieve that, I like to toast in a pan because the butter melts and caramelizes and it gets a crisp crust on the outside of the bread. And then on the inside, it can be kind of steamed and chewy and nice. But when you take it out of the pan, if you were to just throw it onto a cutting board and start layering it with ingredients, we found this out quickly at our restaurant the week we opened. My friend Colleen actually thought this up, is if you give the bread a chance to breathe by putting it on a resting rack or sort of leaning it up against each other like an A-frame, you can give it time to, like, I don't know, breathe, as you said. So get some airflow around there, and then the crispy outside stays crispy. So when you put the ingredients on there, it sort of has that that base structural integrity to slop things on top and still have like toast texture on the outside of the bread. But on the inside, if you cut it thick enough, we'll have that nice like chew that you want out of sandwich bread as well.
It's Food Friday. We're getting great sandwich making advice from Mason Hereford. He has a restaurant in New Orleans called Turkey and the Wolf and a new cookbook called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite sandwich of all time, or maybe a sandwich that went wrong. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Ross is with us now in Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi, Rob and Nathan. I've been to New Orleans for the Jazz Fest, and the restaurants down there are phenomenal. And I'm looking forward. I'm hoping to get there next year and check out your sandwich shop. So I was somewhere down in the near the French Quarter, whatever, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get myself a shrimp po' boy, and kind of looking forward to it. And when I got it, I was sort of left wanting. It was like there just wasn't much there. It was some bread, some shrimp, and I don't know if there was much else on there. What is a po' boy, and do you make them?
Ross, thanks for the call. Well, Mason, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think what you have hit on is not all po' boys are the same. And there are, like any sandwiches, there are places that make them surprisingly well. And then there's places that, you know, maybe fall short for a number of reasons. Maybe it was a more touristy spot, which sometimes there are downtown. There's also a lot of gems downtown in the French Quarter. But what a po' boy is traditionally is a fried seafood or a roast beef sandwich. And there's a few other types of po' boy, but that's what you're going to traditionally see. It all comes down to the French bread. It's going to be on 6, 8, or 12-inch French bread. And French bread in New Orleans is made a certain way and has a certain crumb and texture and crust. So that's very important to the sandwich. And then on top of that, you're going to have your central ingredients, and everyone dresses them differently. But you order your po' boy dressed, which a lot of times will mean lettuce, tomato, pickles, onions, plus or minus one or two of those ingredients, and then mayonnaise and hot sauce, or mayonnaise and ketchup if it's going to be with fried seafood or roast beef. But it sounds like yours didn't have enough sauce, or maybe the seafood didn't have enough seasoning or something to make it all pop, because a really good shrimp po' boy, in my opinion, is hard to beat. But to answer your question about whether I make them, I do not make them. In New Orleans, we saw a very serious opportunity to open a sandwich shop that wasn't a po' boy shop, because we had so many po' boy shops, but not so many just clear sandwich shops that make non-po' boys.
Ross, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's meet one of those not po' boys. The Bel Air is one of the this one sounds really good. It's a ham sandwich. I think you call it the ham sandwich of your dreams. Tell us the story of the Bel Air.
So the Bel Air is named after some gas station outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, the town I grew up in the middle of Virginia. There is a gas station called The Market at Bel Air. We called it the Bel Air Market. But it's between where I grew up and getting into the city proper. So when we were driving into town, as we referred to it, I would often stop at this gas station and get one of their amazing sandwiches. My favorite of which is this one. It was called the Jefferson there, and it was made with turkey. We reinterpreted it as a ham sandwich that we've named in the cookbook as the Bel Air, which is ham that we often make in house. Not so much anymore, but whatever. An herb mayonnaise, aged cheddar cheese, arugula, and cranberry sauce. And it's a very faithful representation of the one I grew up eating like two or three times a week on a good week in Charlottesville, Virginia at Bel Air Market.
And did I read this right? The Bel Air Market now has named a sandwich after you?
Yeah, you know, at first I got a little heat. People were like, you know, this sandwich shop is getting a slight acclaim, and they've clearly ripped off a sandwich from their hometown and talk about it as if they'd done nothing wrong. And I did talk to them about it. And since then, they've discussed that they're so happy and proud to see the sandwich in a new city and it doing well. And they have done something I found very exciting, which is put a bologna sandwich on their menu after one of our best sellers. And they named it A Touch of Mason, which was an honor to have.
We're talking to Chef Mason Hereford about his new cookbook. It's called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans, featuring quirky twists on some Southern classics, especially sandwiches. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Our guest is a sandwich connoisseur. Are you? Do you have a favorite sandwich or a problem? You know, they're always better when somebody else makes it for you, right? Well, maybe you need an extra tip, a secret to make your sandwiches better. Share your favorites, share your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe a nostalgic sandwich favorite from your childhood. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Chef Mason Hereford about his new cookbook, Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. Lots of great sandwich advice, especially from his restaurant, Turkey and the Wolf in New Orleans. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a nostalgic childhood favorite sandwich? Do you have a nostalgic current favorite sandwich you love to make, or at least love to eat? Whoever makes it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dan is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Dan, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Dan?
Well, I used to, when I was a kid, coming home from school in the summertime, we always had cucumbers. So I would take cucumbers that were in mayonnaise along with a little bit of vinegar, put it on some nice thick toast, and then drizzle it with A1 sauce, and it was probably one of my favorite sandwiches, and I still make it today.
You still make it today. Now, do other people like it when you make it, or is it all about that nostalgia for you?
I don't think anybody else would like it. It's just all nostalgia.
That sounds like a pretty good combination to me, Dan. How about you, Mason?
I mean, I think it sounds nice and balanced. I'll have to give it a try.
Fantastic, Dan. I love it. And I remember my fridge sandwich was, I loved when we had leftover meatloaf and making a meatloaf sandwich with a whole bunch of barbecue sauce on it. Can you talk, Mason, about how you go about, like, I don't know, being a mad scientist a little bit like this and finding ingredients that go well together on a sandwich?
I'm very lucky to work with an amazing team of cooks in the kitchen at both of our restaurants. And we like to sort of start with one idea in mind, and maybe there's a leader who takes a dish in a certain direction, but we all like to work together to bounce ideas off each other. Because a lot of times if you, as you mentioned, have a dish that's nostalgic to you, it might not be as presentable to the general populace in the same way. So we try to make everything a team effort, build ideas off each other, and you know, the more brains you have at the table, the more interesting a concoction you can come up with, in my opinion.
Thanks again for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Danielle is with us now in La Crosse. Danielle, hi.
Hi. So my story is that this was something that my dad made, and I've never heard it anywhere else, and I don't know why it ever became a thing, but whenever we would have Hamburger Helper as kids, he would always have bread and creamy peanut butter on the table, and you would make peanut butter bread, two slices, and then you put Hamburger Helper in the middle of it, and you'd eat it like a sandwich.
Okay, you did that as a kid, Danielle. Have you done it as a grown-up?
I have not. I don't eat meat anymore.
Oh,
so,
okay. That'll kill the Hamburger Helper.
I will have to ask my dad if he still makes that.
Danielle, fantastic. Now, that might sound weird to people, but hang on. You've got a not yo mama's peanut butter bacon burger. Mason, beef and peanut butter can live happily together?
That is a fact. Beef and peanut butter, especially with bacon, in my opinion, is an excellent combination. And I would not be against a peanut butter and Hamburger Helper sandwich.
Fantastic, Danielle. Thanks for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Mason, a theme in a lot of your recipes is the abundant use of mayonnaise. And I guess I've had a mayonnaise conversion. I'm from the Midwest. I like mayonnaise, you know, and I like water, right? But I've just in the last couple of years learned to like really like mayonnaise and do cool stuff and use it in different things. Can you talk about how you like to use mayo?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of good jokes there that I'm going to stay away from. But we use mayonnaise for all sorts of things. Obviously on a lot of our sandwiches and a lot of our sauces for sandwiches are mayonnaise with cool ingredients mixed in, whether it be purees or hot sauces or pestos or this and that. Other things we use mayonnaise for, let me think here. Oh, I put a little mayonnaise in the ceviche recipe in the book. It's actually an agua chile, and it's based on a Peruvian idea. I had a Peruvian ceviche once that had a little bit of mayonnaise in there for creamy texture. I also put a tiny bit of mayonnaise in a white bean hummus to add to the creamy texture. And that one was sort of hilariously on brand for us. I'm trying to think. You can bake with mayonnaise. I know that there's different cake ideas that have mayonnaise in there. The possibilities are endless. Also, if you have a sauce that breaks, it can help re-emulsify sauces. If that's good.
Fantastic. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Mason Hereford on Food Friday. His new cookbook is called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. Karen is with us now in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm originally from Madison here in Wisconsin, but lived in Boston for 35 years, and I am thoroughly addicted to Fluffernutter sandwiches, which is peanut butter and marshmallow fluff. The, you know, it's marshmallow cream, but it's the brand Fluff. And you put them both together, and you have a Fluffernutter sandwich.
I got to ask, Karen, is this a main course or is it a dessert?
Well, that depends on how addicted you get to it. It's sweet. It's awfully sweet. But it's awfully well, good.
Karen, thanks a lot for that. Mason, do you go? Do you do sweet sandwiches that might cross the line into a I guess, dessert sandwich?
Sure, why not? I'm down with a fluffernutter. That sounds delicious. I might make one right after this.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Karen. Joanne joins us now in Madison. Joanne, hi.
Hi. Ever since I was a child, we always put peanut, well, when we make a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich, we make it on toast. We put peanut butter on the toast first, and you put the bacon on top of the peanut butter and continue making the sandwich the way you like it, with or without mayo. And it's delicious, and I have converted so many friends to eating peanut butter and peanut butter BLTs.
Interesting. Joanne, thanks a lot for that. And we've got another caller, I think, who's thinking about peanut butter on their sandwiches. Mason, this takes me, I don't know. I think we get locked into, we keep doing our sandwiches the same way again and again. And we're hearing people here, and you, of course, getting creative. Do you have thoughts on encouraging the rest of us to try something different that we might, you know, initially turn our noses up at on our sandwiches?
Yeah, you know, I think variety is the spice of life, honestly. And I also think there's a lot of really great savory uses for peanut butter. Peanut butter BLT sounds perfect, in my opinion. But yeah, I think that it's easy to fall into that trap that a sandwich is like exactly what you expect it to be. And I always encourage people to get weird. I say let your freak flag fly on this one.
I want to check out one more sandwich. Actually, we had a caller earlier who said she doesn't eat meat anymore. So this is one for her, I think. A melt sandwich, a collard melt, collard greens. Can you tell us about how this one comes together?
Yeah, so the collard green sandwich, or the collard green melt, as we call it, is tied with our most popular sandwich that we serve. I've been lucky enough to cook it in other countries even. It's been really fun. But basically, it's served triple-decker, almost like a club sandwich. But other than that, there is no overlap. What we have is seeded rye bread, three thinner slices of seeded rye bread that's toasted and on a griddle, Swiss cheese melted, stewed collard greens that we have a recipe in the cookbook that we, you know, over the years, we found out our very specific way that we love to make them for this sandwich. We do a Russian dressing that contains chopped up pickled cherry peppers and coleslaw. And the whole thing, when you eat it together, almost tastes like a vegetarian, like soul food version of a Reuben sandwich. And it's definitely one of our most popular dishes for sure.
That sounds fantastic. And Mason, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was fun.
That's Mason Hereford, chef and owner of restaurants in New Orleans. He talked to us about his cookbook named after one of those restaurants. It's called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. hey, still time for you to share your all-time sandwich favorites, and seem to have struck a nerve if you put peanut butter on sandwiches that most people wouldn't expect you to put peanut butter on. We want to hear about it. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR with your favorite sandwich creations. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, the election review led by former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman appears to be over after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss fired Gableman. What came out of it all? Take a look at the long saga and join in with your thoughts, your questions. That's The Morning Show. It's coming up Monday morning at 7:30. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. Here's some bonus sandwich advice from me to you. It's not fancy. A thing I used to do when I made a sandwich for myself was not cut it in half. Why? I don't know. Seemed self-indulgent or something. If I made sandwiches for someone else, like my kids, for example, sure, I'd cut it in half, quarter, whatever it takes. For me, it's not worth the bother. That one time I thought, why not? It takes like 1 second to do it. And you know what? It's just way better that way. I don't know why. Magic? Maybe. Probably magic. So cut that sandwich in half. You're worth it. Advanced culinary news you can use. This is Central Time.